Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Good day. Welcome to New Books in History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. My name is Dr. Charles Cotillo of the Royal Historical Society. I'm a host on the channel, and today I'm pleased to have with us Professor Justin Quinn Olmsted. Professor Olmsted is Assistant Professor of History at the University of Central Oklahoma, and today we are speaking about his newest book, United States' Entry into the First World War: The Role of British and German Diplomacy. Welcome, Professor Olmsted.
Thank you, Charles. It's a pleasure to be here.
Professor, what is the thesis of your book?
In a more simplified version, my thesis is that there needs to be a closer look at the actual diplomacy that Britain and Germany used towards the United States during the American period of neutrality. In my view, the Germans get short shrift, and the British get overplayed generally.
So, in essence, you're looking at how effective Germany's and the UK's diplomacy was in the American context the book concentrates on the period between 1914 and 1917.
Yes, in essence. And I will just add that one of the things that I try and do that's connected to the thesis here is that diplomacy, as the British and the Germans saw it, was not just something that happened in 1914. There is a long game that they play, if you will, that is build up to how they react to not just one another, but to the United States and how they deal with the United States once the First World War commences.
What were the difference in closeness between the Anglo-American and German-American relations in the years prior to the outbreak of the Great War?
So when it comes to the British-American relationship, you know, it's very it's odd, right? I mean, the United States has this love-hate relationship with the British. Obviously, the issues with having been a colony and having had to fight a war to separate from the British Empire, Americans still felt very close. That they had the common language, they had a lot of other commonalities as well, and that plays into how the British and the Americans get along. Now, at the same time, America is a country of immigrants, and so a large Irish immigration to the United States leads to a large Irish-American population that is rather hostile to the British. We know, obviously, that Irish patriots during the war, there were a number of them that saw a potential British loss in the war as an event that would give Ireland its independence, and that goes as well to other immigrant groups from the British Empire, such as Indians as well. For the Germans, you know, again, Germany has a lot of immigrants to the United States as well, and at one point, I think something like 20% of non-native born Americans are of German ancestry. So there's a large connection there as well as far as the immigrants. The Prussia was one of the first countries to recognize an independent United States. They worked to, during the American Civil War, to fund the Union. They issued bonds to help the Union support their war efforts, whereas Britain and most of Europe did not. So there's this, if you will, a closeness that's trying to be developed. Germany spends their time working to make a closer connection as well, right? So they have you have professorial exchanges. Johns Hopkins University, with their contingent of German professors, institutes a graduate scheme that suddenly becomes what all American universities use, and it's a German university scheme. Kaiser eventually sends his brother over to travel America and try and make a connection with the Americans and build that relationship and tighten that relationship. While at the same time, Germany is often seen as militant, as aggressive and trying to create world hegemony for themselves. And that butts up against American ideals of as the United States attempts to have its own place in the world and its own empire. So you see the two countries butting up against each other in far off places such as, you know, Samoa and China and the Philippines, when they could have easily have avoided those issues.
So that for you would explain why prior to 1914, the image of Germany declined in the United States.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there are there's an issue with pork. Germany doesn't want to. It's essentially a trade issue between Germany and the United States, and there are threats that get thrown back and forth across there, across the ocean. When you look at the issues in Samoa in particular, you get threats of war from American senators that if Germany doesn't back down. And so, yeah, this whenever the United States came up to Germany, it was rarely a it was rarely harmless in the as far as Americans saw it. There was always a competition with Germany, and it makes some real sense, the fact that both countries are young countries in comparison. Both countries are trying to find their place in the world at the same time, and so they become kind of natural competitors at the same time frame in that 1860s, 1870s, 1880s era.
Why was British Great War diplomacy so successful in manipulating, if you allow me to use that term, Colonel House and President Wilson?
I think there's a number of reasons, but I think that we can start with some naivete on House and Wilson's part. I don't want to take anything away from either man. Both of them were very good at things they have done in the past. I think that Wilson makes a lot of good decisions as president. House clearly has a very good political mind. He made his name in Texas. He identifies Wilson as somebody that can take him to the national stage, and he then works, if you will, behind the scenes to help Wilson as he goes along. But he has these aspirations of being a great world diplomat with no background behind it. So when he goes off to work and talk to the British and the Germans and everybody else, he's at a distinct disadvantage. And this goes back to my comment earlier that the British and the Germans have been playing this diplomatic game for centuries. America has always looked at diplomacy as kind of a dirty thing that has to be done, and so they only deal with it when they have to. It's event by event, whereas the British and the Germans both played, as I mentioned earlier, that long game. Whatever the diplomatic policy is, it can maneuver, it can change, but it's all part of a greater plan. And Wilson's just not used to this yet. When it comes to the 1913 through 1918 timeframe, Sir Edward Grey is, despite any faults that people may attribute to him, he was good at his job. He understood what other diplomats were trying to do. He understood what their personalities were like. I mentioned in the book that one of the things that both Germany and Britain did well was use their ambassadors in other countries to provide them with information about individuals. So in this case, President Wilson and Colonel House their dossiers get sent back to London and Berlin about their personalities, about what they like, what they don't like, what their weaknesses are, if you will. So when House meets Sir Edward Grey for the first time and Grey sits down and just wants to chat with him, I mean, this is what House wants to see happen. He wants to not deal with the pageantry of European diplomacy, right? That's what so many Americans dislike, because it feels fake. So when the Sir Edward Grey sits down with House, it's personal. They can chat about anything and everything under the sun. It appears that the conversation flows from one subject to another. And that's what makes, in many cases, British diplomacy so successful. House feels at home with Grey. Grey takes the time to flatter him, even after a meeting, catching him the next day, and just saying, just wanted to tell you how much I appreciated the conversation and how much we like you and the president, and I'm going to make some comments on the floor of Parliament today towards that end. Bringing in names like such, everything from the prime minister to the chancellor of the exchequer, those kinds of if you will, the titles, even though it is pageantry, are still flattering to people like Colonel House. And so by getting in, if you will, on his good side and talking to him, that makes a huge step towards a successful diplomacy on the British part. The other thing I would say that makes the British so successful in this case is that they are Grey not only uses flattery, but he also puts things off, right? So if there's something he knows that House and Wilson don't like, he can say, "Well, let's not worry about that right now. We can change that," and he can postpone decisions that might affect the relationship, only to bring them back later when he's had the opportunity to gauge the American reaction to things.
Was not Wilson's and House's proposed Anglo-German-American coalition, this is pre-Great War, at cross-purposes with British Entente policy?
British Entente policy is something that is, I think, often misunderstood. I mean, the whole point for the British with the Entente is to free themselves from the budgetary restraints that would be placed on them if they were to maintain standing armies to deal with the Russians or with the French. It was all related to freeing up pounds to do other things with, whether it's working with the Navy or more importantly, dealing with civil issues. So when House and Wilson want to see something done that is with the British and the Germans, Sir Edward Grey thought that Russia was going to be the great stabilizing force in Europe. He did not believe that Britain had to be the bulwark against a rising Germany. So if there was a potential to work with Germany, I don't think Britain was necessarily opposed to that at all.
Why do you say that British diplomacy had, quote, a point of domination over American diplomacy circa 1914?
Because I think that, as I mentioned a little bit ago, the British were just more adept at it. The British were playing a longer game, and they could see from the conversations basically that their ambassadors had with American diplomats and their own, like Cerber Gray's discussions as well. They could see what it was the United States wanted to achieve in many cases, and they were able to manipulate the Americans to the direction they wanted to. I think it was Samuel Flagg Bemis that made the original comment about the domination of British diplomacy over American diplomacy. And again, it goes back to the Americans didn't like it. The Americans weren't good at it. The British did like diplomacy, and they were good at it. And so they were able to maneuver things to their positions.
Why did President Wilson not try to enforce on the UK strict adherence to the Declaration of London as per neutrality rights?
That's an excellent question that gets – I think that Isabel Hull in her book, A Scrap of Paper, really goes into great detail on that. But the general idea is that he didn't find it in America's best interest in many cases, right? So the United States starts trading with all the combatants because the United States needs the money, right? When the First World War begins, the United States is on the verge of a recession, and so they see this as an opportunity, despite what Wilson says about not wanting to participate in war and that cash is one of the worst, is almost worse than munitions itself. He sees the need for the United States to develop these things. When it comes to trying to enforce laws of neutrality, again, this goes back to what the British did, what Monsieur Regret does well. They can stop lots of ships at sea. However, they never go so far as to really antagonize the president. I mentioned that Sir Edward Grey goes to the Admiralty and encourages the prize courts in London to move quickly on any ships carrying American cargo, to move them along quickly. Through diplomacy, they find out that the U.S. is sending out a test case ship, so that if the British stop it to search it for contraband, that if the United States could then potentially really bring this up in a court of arbitration, if you will, with the British, or force a point. And the British use the French to stop the ship instead. Okay, so they turn things on their heads to keep the Americans off balance. I would also say I think that not just from the political and diplomatic acumen of Grey and the British themselves, one of the reasons that Wilson I think hesitates is his individual love for everything British, right? I mean, he's quoted as having said, everything I love, the dearest or hold the most dear in the world is English, and the British knew that, and they used that to their advantage as well.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Did the British ambassador to the United States Sir Archibald Spring Rice have a good relationship with President Wilson and Colonel House?
You know what? Difficult question on that one. The idea that he has a good relationship with Wilson's is rough because, one, he was very close to Theodore Roosevelt. Wilson didn't interact individually a lot with people. Cecil Spring Rice did work with Colonel House, and they knew that House had Wilson's ear. So if he was in good with House, they felt that they could get their point across to the president. And that being said, I can't say that it was a great relationship, but I think that it was not a bad relationship, if that makes sense.
Why was the American response to German declaration of a war zone around the British Islands so much more forceful than its response to the UK violations of neutrality rights?
Well, because there's a distinct difference, I think, in most people's minds between stopping a ship, hauling it into port, holding it there until they've decided whether there's contraband or not, and then releasing it or taking the contraband off the ship, and which is what the British are doing, and sinking ships the high sea, which is what the German unrestricted submarine warfare was intent on doing. So I think that plays a large part in it. We also have to remember that in 1914, submarines are still relatively new. People see them as sneaky because they're under the, they're under the water and they can sink a ship without warning, whereas you can see a surface ship as it approaches you. So even just the thoughts of what could occur using submarine warfare plays into this. And with the loss of life, and I think that goes a lot towards Wilson's personality, to his belief system, to his Presbyterian background as well.
You describe the diplomacy that resulted in the Arabic pledge as, quote, a triumph for Bethmann Hollweg being the German imperial chancellor. Why was it a triumph?
Well, because he was able to continue the submarine warfare at this time, right? I mean, the idea being that the Arabic is sunk, but it's not. I think the ship, the submarines were on the surface. They were able to kind of keep the Americans at bay. One of the things that I point out in the book is that when the Germans would sink a ship, and if there was loss of life, it was kind of a mea culpa that would occur, and they would begin negotiations with the United States to figure out how much those lives that may have been lost were worth, and then they would offer to make that payment to those families. And this is something that has happened, for 100 years prior to this as well. So for the Germans, this was nothing new, but doing these negotiations with the United States, that essentially allowed them to continue using submarines, even if they, in this case, after the Arabic pledge, that they would surface and fire the warning shots and search the ships and try not to just sink ships that are coming going unconditionally.
What was the House Gray Memorandum, and why was it important?
So in many cases, the House Gray Memorandum gets overblown as well in history. The House Gray Memorandum, Colonel House and Sir Edward Gray get together. Sir Edward Gray gets House to pledge American support for Britain and the Allies in the case that Germany refuses to negotiate a peace. So the idea here is that the British and the Allies will make a peace offer to sit down at a table with the Germans and pound things out. If Germany refuses to come to the table, the United States would join the war on the side of the Allies. The importance of it being that this would force America into the war. What becomes important about it is that it makes it seem that the United States is on board with the Allies and that they're happy to go to war, when in reality, House comes back with this agreement, and the president inserts the word probably into the agreement. So instead of saying the United States will go to war on the side of the Allies, it says the United States would probably go to war. I mean, it changes the entire meaning of the document. But for the British, what's important is that they believe that they now have American support to destroy German's military might, simply because Germany says, no, we're not going to sit down. It makes the Germans seem even more warlike, less willing to end the destruction and the death. And it sets America pretty clearly on the side of the British and the Entente.
Was not the main problem with Wilson's attempted peace efforts that the British were unwilling to negotiate in 1915, 1916?
So I think it's fair to say for both countries were, right? So 1915, 1916, from the British point of view, militarily things aren't going so well, and they're not willing to sit down and negotiate from a position of weakness. The same thing occurs later on with the Germans. The reason they don't want to sit down and negotiate in many cases is because they've had some military setbacks. They don't think that they'll be able to negotiate from a position of strength. And so that's for all belligerents during the entire term of the war.
Why did Bethmann Hollweg make his peace offer of 12th December 1916, and how did Wilson react to it?
So Bethmann Hollweg's 1916 peace offer is again, it's a diplomatic move. If peace is achieved at that point, if everybody's willing to sit down and negotiate, then that is great for everybody. It's great for Germany. They can stop the slaughter of their own people as well. But the Germans had realized that despite the fact that they were in a good position, Germany itself was. There's several Allied offenses that had been blunted with great loss for the Allies. And despite the fact that the Ottomans and the Austro-Hungarians were not in great shape, Germany was in pretty good shape itself, and they were able to kind of hold their own. So they saw the attempt to destroy the French and the British militarily, also by keeping the Americans out. So when Bethmann Hollweg makes his 1916 peace attempt, it is, if we get peace, great. If not, we've attempted. We have convinced the Americans that we want to have peace, but it was the British and the French that rejected it. So therefore, the Americans should stay out and allow us to finish them off militarily. And again, this was part of the idea, because Germany knew that even though they were in a good spot, they didn't have much longer to go before they were in a bad spot due to the British blockade and just food issues as well. The Kaiser and the military had asked Bethmann Hollweg to clear the diplomatic routes for unrestricted submarine warfare. They truly believed that if the United States stayed out, they could choke the British out of the war and defeat the French on the battlefield. So it, much like the Sir Robert Gray's the House Gray memorandum trying to get America in a position to either come into the war or stay out, the Germans are doing the exact same thing with Bethmann Hollweg's peace attempts in 1916.
Why did German Foreign Minister Zimmermann send his letter to Mexico offering an alliance with Germany if the United States came into the war?
This is actually one of my favorite parts of this book to research and to write about. We generally look at the Zimmermann telegram as a massive blunder on Zimmermann's part, and the fact that he admits to it is just even more mind-boggling to many people. However, right, if we look at the long game, for Germans, going all the way back through Bismarck, the idea of entangling your enemies or your adversaries in other with other issues, with other small wars. I mean, that's a large part of German foreign policy. I mean, you think of the Kaiser's position in the Boer War. Think of Bismarck's reasonings for getting involved in colonialism was just to keep the French and the British tied down elsewhere with colonial issues. So for Zimmermann's point, if the job is to keep America out of the war, Germany needs to keep them tied down someplace outside of Europe. Well, the most logical place at this point in time is in Mexico. And, you know, just in the recent history of American-Mexican relations in the early 20th century, he has just piles of reasons to why Mexico and the United States should be at each other's throats, right? We can look at everything from the incidents in Tampico, where U.S. troops are rampaging through the city in Veracruz, where they fire on Mexican troops there as well. We have issues of the Mexican Revolution and Pancho Villa raiding into the north, crossing the Rio Grande and into the United States, and being pursued by not just the contingent of American cavalry in Columbus, New Mexico, but a third of the U.S. Army under General Pershing that comes down and forays for about a year in northern Mexico. I mean, these are issues that the United States and Mexico has that Zimmermann recognizes. And if Mexico is willing to say, yes, we'll side with Germany and we'll go to war with America, that should tie down more American troops and American supplies. If America's at war with Mexico, or even if they think they may go to war with Mexico, they can't send guns and bullets to France. They're going to need those for their own troops. They can't send troops to France. They're going to need their troops on that Mexican border. And in the long run, it does not matter to the Germans really whether it's a true threat or not. So if America – all it needs is America to believe that it's a possibility and to tie down their troops. So for Zimmermann's mind, he's making a very Bismarckian diplomatic move to try and entangle America outside of Europe.
Is that why he admitted it?
Yeah, for him, for Zimmermann, there's no reason not to admit it. I mean, and that's kind of his reaction. Yeah, I did. Why would I not have done this? It's the best thing for Germany if America gets tied up with Mexico.
Why did the British wait 1 month to inform the Americans about the letter?
So I think that the British didn't – one, it's about intelligence, right? They don't want the Germans to know that they've broken the code. They don't want them to understand that all everything that they're sending out is being intercepted and transcribed. They also don't want the Americans to know that they are – reading their diplomatic mail, right? So there's a couple of different things that they're trying to hedge their bets on. On top of that, they really thought that the resumption of unrestricted submarine warfare by Germany would drive Wilson into the war. I mean, throughout 1915, 1916, and 1917, you have issue after issue where House Hines Page in London, or Wilson themselves were making these comments about, the loss of American life, the loss of American ships, is going to drive the United States eventually into this war. So as Germany starts sinking ships, there's a grand hope that that's what will bring America in. It becomes more organic that way, that America just can't deal with Germany's destruction of commerce on the open seas, and so that'll bring them in. When that doesn't happen, the British are a bit incredulous. They don't understand why, and they finally have to put the letter out there, because now it is Germany directly threatening American sovereignty, and Americans will take a lot from other countries, but they won't take that direct threat of a possible invasion.
Who would you rate more highly as ambassador, Count Bernstorff or Sir Archibald Springrice?
I think I would probably go. It's difficult. I think Bernstorff has a tougher time of it, right? Because he is he's German. The Americans see the Germans, particularly on the East Coast, they see the Germans as the aggressors in this war. So with that, Bernstorff is always playing catch up. So all the information that the United States gets about the war gets filtered through a British lens. So Bernstorff is constantly having to try and respond instead of getting out ahead of the news service. And so in that case, I would rate him really highly. I also think, again, that he's a guy that was likable and was able to make friends easily. And I would even say that it's his diplomatic acumen that allows Germany to keep America at bay for so long. Springrice gets frustrated with Americans. His letters back to Gray in many cases are negative. His close friendship with Roosevelt sometimes gets in the way of issues with House and Wilson, because Wilson and Roosevelt really aren't that close. But if you're forcing me to choose, I would say that Bernstorff is overall a better diplomat.
Reading the book, one almost comes to the conclusion that the Americans did not possess in this period almost any agency, and that the USA was almost a puppet in the hands of a more masterful British and German diplomacy. Was that the impression you wished to convey?
Short answer, yeah, I did. I wanted to let people know, I mean, maybe not that the Americans were puppets, but that they were easily influenced, that other countries saw the ability and used the ability to manipulate House and Wilson to do their bidding, whether it was to remain out of the war for as long as they did or to eventually get into the war.
What inspired you to write such a wonderful bibliographical essay?
Thank you for that, by the way. It's nice to hear it called a bibliographical essay ever called wonderful. It comes down to, in many cases, to my PhD supervisor, Timothy Baycroft, and my external reviewer, Brian Holden Reed, in particular, both pushed me to talk about the books that I was looking at, in part because they're not all new. So some of the books and some of the articles that I utilize are from the 1920s, 30s, and 40s, and 50s, and have been not disregarded, but put on a shelf and left there by a lot of more recent historians. And so to be able to go back and say, look, some of these books deserve to be looked at again, and here's what they're talking about, was actually an awful lot of fun, and it made if you will, all the additional reading that goes into writing a book feel more worthwhile, if that makes sense.
If you wanted people to take one thing away from your book, what would it be?
One thing away from my book. That's a hard question, because I'm not sure that there's just one. I think that if maybe I would say the one thing to take away from my book is that despite everybody signing on to international agreements and international law, everybody, every country, every diplomat, every politician is willing to break those international laws and norms if it means the survival of their country or their government. And in this case, you can look at it from both Bethmann Hollweg and Zimmermann, or Sir Edward Grey and the blockade and the orders in council. that he helped pass that restricted American trade to the continent.
With that observation, I would like to thank you very much, Professor Olmsted, for being so kind as to speak with us today. This is Charles Cotillo. Thanks for listening to New Books in History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. Thank you, Professor Olmsted.
Thank you, Charles. It's been a pleasure. I had a lot of fun with it.